Ars Electronica, 2006. Simplicity, the art of complexity.
Simple doesn't mean simplistic. And very often, very simple objects take years and years and years to prepare. Sam said that he worked for 2 years on a phone, and some of the objects that I'm going to show you today have taken dozens of years to work on. So what simple really is a long process of synthesis done by somebody of exceptional ability. It takes a lot to be synthetic. And an object that really becomes popular in the world is the repository of so much human knowledge that it made me embrace design as, in my opinion, the highest form of human expression and creativity. This morning you're having quite a good dose of three-dimensional product design, and I think it's very useful because so many of you work very often in a sort of an ethereal dimension, and I think that tangible objects are a good counterpoint to what you do all the time. As John explained to you, I try to work in contemporary design because I feel that contemporary design is really a dimension to knowledge, a dimension of knowledge that is lacking from popular culture, at least in some parts of the world. I moved from Italy to the United States, where design is very often misinterpreted and misunderstood, primarily by the media that very often identify it with decoration, with added value that also increases price and increases cost. And that comes from, I think, a strange complex of inferiority that Americans still have towards Europe. It's very funny, but in American design, until a few years ago, was something European, possibly Italian design, an unattainable sofa that you could buy in Soho in New York, but that you could not afford for many years of your life. And I have to say that something like the iPod really changed it because it brought Americans back in touch with their roots of really tough and rugged and utilitarian industrial design, albeit in a much more elegant and contemporary way. Among the exhibitions that I organized at the Museum of Modern Art, there was this funny little thingy called Humble Masterpieces. Why a funny little thingy? Because it was what American movie critics call a sleeper. It was never meant to be a blockbuster. It was small, without budget. It was an exhibition that I had that kind of fell upon me because of a rotation of curatorial tasks. And it ended up being one of the most successful exhibitions at MoMA. And I think that the reason for that is that people respond to design instinctively, and especially to good design, when they see it. So it's just a matter of teaching people how to understand design, and they will have a much more interesting and much more multidimensional life, and ultimately they will give their feedback by buying or not buying products to manufacturers. So it's really starting to be a consumer's, users, buyers, however you want to call them, world, and it's just waiting to happen. Humble Masterpieces, if we can start with the slideshow. Oh, it's there, perfect. Humble Masterpieces was called so because it was a small exhibition in the middle of the collection gallery. So it was sitting next to the Picassos and Matisses, the non-humble masterpieces. And it was very weird to show to the public an exhibition of very simple objects in that milieu. I'm starting this slideshow with an object that was not in the show, but that I consider really interesting. Design is about making the best out of what you have, out of the tools at hand. And this is a bucket that was designed in Eastern Germany before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Eastern German design of the Soviet era is very interesting because it shows that objects, utilitarian objects, can be done with anything that you have at hand. This is done with a plastic-covered tarp and a piece of iron wire and a piece of wood. It works very well, and it's the best response with the tools at hand. Of course, when you get into a more sophisticated industrial environment, masterpieces of utilitarian design also get more complex. I wanted to show you here a collection of pretty great design objects that are coffee cup lids. And you see how after the first lid, which is basically third row right, the simplest one, all of the other designs that were added afterwards were an increasing complexity that was meant to create pretty much a competition in the market, but they did not improve that much upon the original design that was already quite perfect in itself because it was not very articulated and because it could be molded with a very simple mold. Talking about synthesis, the Bic pen is really an interesting subject. The Bic pen is so called because it was designed by Baron Marcel Bic, who took Laszlo Biro's invention of the ballpoint pen and dedicated many, many years of his life to perfecting it. The first thing that he did is to try and find out what the best metal would be for the ball. And tungsten proved to be much better than the initial iron that Laszlo Biro had used. And then, improvement upon improvement, he chose all the different materials from brass to acetate plastic. He went and found the most innovative types of plastics that were available at that time. Remember, polypropylene was discovered as a molecule in 1948, and actually the discoverer, Giulio Natta, got the Nobel Prize for it. So just a few years later, this new material was applied to this gigantic industrial production, and so on and so forth, until the nicest details, like the two holes in the barrel, one of which is meant to help you not suffocate just in case you swallowed the pen. So it's really interesting how he thought of everything. But what I find fantastic about Marcel Bic is that he devoted his life to three objects: the Bic, the lighter, and the disposable razor. Now, I'm sure that all of you who are in industrial production know dozens and dozens of other projects probably went into the trash bin, but the exceptional synthesis that went into these three evergreen objects is really a feat of human creativity and of human application. And that's why I think that design is so amazing when you really learn how to read it. The Lego is another great example of dedication. It was born as a wooden toy, and then when the plastics were available, it became made of plastic. And even though there have been so many attempts to make variations on the theme, it's very funny how the original assortment of bricks of the same colors without too many instructions is still one of the best sellers in the world. So it's about the unit and essentially distilling the unit so that it becomes really an evergreen object. Of course, when people think of good utilitarian design, they think of an object that apparently is not very simple, but in reality it is, and that's the Swiss knife. I wish I had brought with me a slide of an object that I saw yesterday. One of the two companies that are allowed to make the official Swiss knife did one knife that basically is like a poor boy sandwich that gathers all of the possibilities. It's basically this thick, you know? So next time I do this lecture, I'm going to add to it. But the reason why I want to show you the Swiss knife is that it is complex because it's an assemblage, but in reality it is very simple because the mechanism has been thought of so perfectly as to make it sturdy. And the reason why it became such an icon of good design is because it's multifunctional. But it brings me to talk about the iconic value of these objects that are a synthesis of so much study. The Swiss knife, of course, comes in many different variations, and you know the story. It was first created for the Swiss Army, and then it has like more than 50 different possibilities, each called after the use that it can have. There's also a not very politically correct lady knife that has more tweezers and other objects for, as the Swiss manufacturers think of our beauty. But it comes from multi-tool objects that existed centuries ago. This is a tool that was for a shepherd, I think. I can't remember for, but anyway, it was for shepherds. And it became such an icon that whenever people want to think of good design and transform it into a performance, that's what they use. This is a performance by Frank Gehry and Klaus Oldenburg many years ago at the Biennale of Venice. And you see, the idea was to have a floatable example of great design, and here it is. It was the performance of the knife. And the same idea of the multifunction tool has been also applied in other parts of the world with different nuances and with different atmospheric tinges. For instance, this is the Leatherman tool, which is the American response to the Swiss knife. As you can tell, it's more American. One of the things that I noticed when I got to the States was how everything, I remember getting out of JFK and noticing the guardrail of the freeway and the cars and the taxis. And I thought, everything in the United States seems to be wider and made with lesser material and done in a more rugged and manly way. In a way, look at this Leatherman tool. It's very useful and it's very well done, but it has a completely different gestalt. So it is a different object unto itself. This is how it is when it's closed. Other examples of great syntheses, as an Italian and as a wine fan, just like Walter, I also really am interested in corkscrew. And I have to say that this particular American corkscrew, the screw pull, is quite amazing. It has a continuous screw movement that enables you to extract the cork in a much easier way. And it's done with injection plastic in a very easy way and able to keep the price down and keep it available to everybody, which is another great sign of good design. Other American feats. This one you might know is also a great example of creativity. Ice cream scoops used to be basically spoons made of metal, so the cold temperature of the metal made the ice cream stick to the spoon itself. This American inventor found a way to put some warming liquid, some liquid that really took the temperature of the hand within the handle, with the result that the ice cream falls from the scoop very easily. But a second result is that the ice cream seller will be able to actually make this curl of ice cream that will contain less ice cream than a real spoonful would have. And therefore, you have more volume with less ice cream and a better sales rate. So it's really interesting. You know, design always has a hidden agenda. So this was the exhibition. You see, it's so small. We were in Queens at that time. I don't know if you remember, but MoMA was temporarily in Queens while we were expanding our location in Manhattan. And there was this gallery that was, in Italy we would call it the Pepa Tencia, the Queen of Spades, the card that you don't want to have to be left holding after the game is finished. You know, when you have that card, you lose. And this little gallery was a headache because you had to make an exhibition with basically no money using the collection in a very small space. So I thought, small space, small objects, well, if they're small, why not make them also very cheap and available? And since they're amidst the Matisse and Picasso, let's call them humble, but they're still masterpieces. So you see, it's all a game of default. And what I did is on the walls, I put the history of 11 of these objects. Why 11? Because I had money only for 11 panels. So it really is interesting. It was really done with a lot of love, but also under a lot of constraints. And people flocked to this show and really enjoyed everything that was there. You know, I also had this new Band-Aid. Well, it's not that new anymore, but it's a Band-Aid for blisters. It's beautiful because it's like a translucent slug, and you apply it directly on the blister. And then you leave it there for 4 days. And then when you peel it off, it's like the Green Mile. I don't know if you've seen that exhibition in which the evil goes from one man to the other because of magic. It's as if the Band-Aid had absorbed all the evil juices of your blister and your skin is perfect. You know, it's very, very magical. So there were objects like this Band-Aid, like the Duracell AA battery, which is in the collection. If you think of the icon of a battery and you close your eyes, you think of a AA and you probably think of Duracell. So it's this kind of attempt at understanding icons. But also what was great is that we left in the exhibition these books for people to nominate their own masterpieces. And I have to tell you, I've never changed so many books a week. And of course, you know, whenever you put these books in an exhibition, you get a certain rate of semi-porn and stupid messages. I was astounded at how low this rate was this time. People were really nominating their own humble masterpieces. All the Italians were naming the pizza. All the Spaniards were naming the fregona, which is the mop, to mop the floor. I didn't know that Spaniards invented the fregona, but they were really proud of that. And here is this woman from Kentucky who put something, you know, like liquid nails, you know, all the stereotypes of Kentucky she had there with pride. It was a beauty. So when I finally did a book about the exhibition, I included also some of the suggestions from the people, from the public of the exhibition. It was quite beautiful. Now, the tradition of humble masterpieces is not something I invented at all. The museum's collection of design started with the ball bearing. In 1934, it was Philip Johnson's show that was called Machine Art, which was an attempt to bring out pieces of machinery, cogs, propellers, coils, and show them in a museum context they were never seen before on white pedestals against white walls as if they were Brancusi sculptures, and all of a sudden put in the face of the world the beauty of the machine. You know, it was 1934, so that was really the avant-garde. So this ball bearing remains an icon of the collection in a way, as does this gorgeous propeller blade or this wonderful saw blade. So you see, there's really a lot of space for these objects, and this tradition can be brought to today. One exhibition that we did at MoMA in the 1980s was called, not Machine Art anymore, but Information Art. And it was an exhibition of the diagrams that chip engineers used at that time to check and make sure that chips were well manufactured. So they were magnifications of computer chips. And this is a neural network chip. So it's interesting how also the shape of the architecture of the landscape of the chip kind of already suggests the use of the chip itself. So the tradition continues, and it moves on also to, for instance, such a staple of design as food. I'm using here the cover of the New York City Access Guide by Ricky Saul Warman because he is the one that actually chose this amazing icon, which is the bagel. The next book that I'm working on is a book about basic foods from all over the world as great examples of design, because indeed, foods, basic units, not plates, are examples of what I think that design without designers is. Really ancestral, millennia-old design that does not have a name attached and cannot have a name attached, because I'm showing you here pasta without names attached, and here's a pasta designed by Giugiaro, which was a complete disaster. Somehow, food cannot easily be designed. Of course, there are some exceptions. There are some chefs today, like Ferran Adrià, that are truly innovators, technological innovators, but this was really funny because Barilla commissioned Giugiaro to do this pasta, and if they had had in the focus group one Italian woman, they would have known before putting it out in the market that it wouldn't work. You can tell how it's going to overcook at the extremities and it's going to undercook where there's the double swirl. So it was on the market for like 1 week before the Italian housewives just decreed its death. But in a way, the real icon of this kind of design that I can bring you as an example, besides the Bic, is the post-it note that John loves so much. You should see he was like putting one post-it note on top of each other. That's how he does the notes for his lectures. You probably all know the story of the post-it note. The post-it note happened over like 25 years, and it happened at first with a perceived mistake because Spence Silver, a chemical engineer at 3M in the 60s, developed this adhesive that he thought was a failure because it wouldn't really stick. It was made of many microspheres that could be popped away if you remove the paper. So he put it on a shelf, a semi-failure shelf, and about 20 years later, his colleague Art Fry, who was singing in a choir but dropping the bookmarks all the time, said, oh, wait a second, there's that flop by Spence, let me try. So he just slopped some on bookmarks, and sure enough, he was able to put and remove bookmarks from his hymnal pages without losing them. So he brought it to his higher-ups at 3M, and slowly but surely, of course, it's not something that happens overnight, but the post-it note was born. And it's funny how you can read things, you can read your own ideas into these objects, because I remember saying, oh, yes, the post-it note, you know, the design critic, you always have to overdo it. Post-it note, it's square, which is the emblem of rationality, and it's yellow, which is the color of attention. In truth, it was yellow because it was the only color that could be photocopied at that time, besides white. But this is just an example of an object that seems to be absolutely simple, but it's so complex, it has part of the history of at least two human beings, but in truth, hundreds of them, a company, a market, and a whole country and the world in it. And that's what I think that the best design is, a synthesis of human history and creativity. Thank you very much. Shall I take one question or you want to? One? One. Okay, good. Even better.
I have to think of a question first.
Oh, sorry. Oh, okay. You could have given out cows instead of T-shirts.
How do you like New York?
Do I like? Yeah. And you know why I love New York? Because it's the most complex and the simplest city in the world. That's a good example of masterpiece. Even humble. Okay. Thank you.
Yep.